opting to take the group and move down outside onto the grass and do it outside. We feel this room is getting so warm anyway.
For what it's worth,
our moderator for this second session is Dr. Richard Sherlock, who is professor of philosophy at Utah State University, and we're very happy that he'd be here with us today. I'm going to turn the time to him, and we're going to have to move quickly. Richard?
Okay, because for some reason we didn't anticipate, I don't know who didn't anticipate the...
Stand up.
No, the microphone is on because they're recording.
Recording. That's
all. Okay, you people may have to stand up to be heard. I didn't think I ever had to stand up to be heard, but we're in a time constraint. We need to be out of here at 12:15. We need to, when you leave, take your chairs back around the tables where we took them from. So we're going to have to go move real quickly. And I would like panelists, if they could keep their comments to 5 minutes to 7 minutes. I'm sorry, you were told 10 to 12, but if we're going to have to be out of here in less than an hour now, slightly, try and keep your comments as close to 7 minutes as possible. If you have to go over, you have to go over. But we've got five people. If we all take 7 minutes, then we'll get some time for questions. If we don't. Okay.
Don't introduce.
I am not going to... I'm going to let the panelists say whatever they want about themselves. Jan, Paul, Maxine, Blake.
Mark,
they can say whatever they want to say or nothing. I think we all know them. Enough said. Who wants to start? Let's just go to... We want to go this end?
Let's go according to the program.
How am I supposed to hold my...
What's
the
program?
Yeah. We know.
She's first.
She's first. All right.
Change my glasses.
You can just hold this. I think it's probably easier than...
You want me to hold it for you? Hold this.
Hold that. That would help.
I'll hold that, David, so you don't have to be standing there.
I'll put it in my pocket.
I'm going to step out here so you'll have a better chance of hearing me. My name is Janice Allred. What I want to do today is talk just a little bit about my view of theology. Several years ago, I overheard a conversation between my two sons, Nephi and Joel, ages 2 and 4. They were sitting on the couch with their arms around each other looking at an illustrated Book of Mormon for children, which I had been reading to them. Joel, pointing to a picture supposed to represent the prophet Ether, said, "Look, Nephi, there's Ether." Nephi replied, "No, Joel, it's Ether." To which Joel responded, "Yes, it's Ether." They then calmly turned the page. This little exchange represents to me a paradigm for a theological discussion. It is grounded in the scriptures. Each person interprets it according to his abilities and experience. An effort is made to harmonize views, but differences do not lead to a break in fellowship. The starting point of Mormon theology is a story. The story of the boy, Joseph Smith, who wanted to know his standing with God. Neither the Bible nor the creeds of the churches nor the professors of religion were able to answer his question. So he sought his answer directly from God. Jesus Christ appeared to him in a vision and answered his questions. Revelation is an event. It is an experience in which God or a heavenly messenger or the Spirit of God comes into contact with a person and gives him something. The gift may be words imparting knowledge or commandments, a vision of the future or of heaven, or the sense of God's love and care and involvement. Theology is the discipline which studies God and mankind and their relationship. Friedrich Schleiermacher, the German Protestant theologian, considered to be the father of modern theology, maintained that any given theology must represent and refer to the doctrines of some particular Christian body at some particular time. In other words, there can be no general theology because theology must be based on experience. It seems to me that every theology must recognize and interpret Revelation must give some significance to it. But for Mormon theology, revelation must be fundamental. Yet, revelation and theology are fundamentally different. Revelation is holistic, while theology is a form of knowledge. Thus, theology must be essentially interpretive. The theologian deals primarily with texts. The primary text is the scriptures. But the scriptures themselves are not revelation itself, but a compilation of accounts of revelations, interpretations of revelations, inspired sermons, history interpreted as God's dealings with man, parables, myths, and even theology. The interpretations of theologians, as well as the writings of prophets, are influenced by their own philosophical assumptions about the nature of truth and reality, their cultural background, their language, their own experience, their writing ability, the questions they choose to ask, and others. Given all these variables, it is apparent that the task of theology is infinite. But Mormon theology has been dominated by three approaches. I call these the orthodox, the scholarly, and the philosophical. The orthodox approach assumes that there is a body of doctrine which is found in scriptures and the teachings of the prophets. The task of the theologian as they see it is to extract this doctrine and present it in propositional form. Those who take this approach make a rigid distinction between doctrine and speculation. For them, doctrine is the fundamental truths about the Godhead, salvation, priesthood, authority, which are clearly taught by the scriptures and the prophets. And speculation is thinking about questions of interest but not vital importance about which there is some information. But the authoritative answer on such questions has not yet been given. Orthodox Mormons believe in continuing revelation, but they believe it simply adds details. They do not believe that it could fundamentally change what they regard as doctrine. The idea of a paradigm shift in doctrine would not occur to them. The scholarly approach to Mormon theology recognizes a range of views on theological questions, both in the scriptures and among Mormon writers and thinkers. Their principal concern is to discover, document, categorize, and compare and contrast these views. Their studies are usually presented from a historical or sociological point of view. The philosophical approach to Mormon theology begins with philosophy. Those who take this approach explore a philosophical or theological question using Mormon ideas on the nature of God, man, free agency, reality, law, etc., to suggest a solution to or a new way of thinking about the question. The methodology of this approach is philosophical, although the thinker may assume his Mormon insights are true without attempting to support them philosophically. I believe that if Mormon theology is to be vital, we must take a new approach to theology, which I will call constructive theology. In calling this way of doing theology new, I do not mean to imply that no one has yet taken this approach. I believe theology has been done this way from the beginning, and I think we need to reclaim this kind of theology. Some of us, I think, are starting to do this. I also do not wish to imply that the three approaches I have characterized are of no value or should be done away with, rather that they are incomplete. Their discoveries and methods, however, can be useful for constructive theology. And to characterize the way I do theology and the way I think others do it, I'm going to compare and contrast it to the other three approaches. Like Orthodox theology, Mormon constructive theology must hold revelation to be fundamental. Joseph Smith said that you can learn more about God by gazing into heaven for 5 minutes than by reading all the books that have ever been written about him. If you have not had the experience of gazing into heaven or conversing with angels, then you can learn more about God from reading the accounts of such experiences by those who have had them than by reasoning about what a perfect being must be like. Unlike Orthodox theologians, however, constructive theologians recognize the gap between revelation and theology and understand the interpretive nature of theology. Although, like Orthodox theologians, they make a distinction between fundamental and secondary doctrines, they do not hesitate to re-examine fundamental doctrines because they reject an absolute conception of truth in favor of a contextual view of truth. Fundamental doctrines, if they are to be vital truths rather than idols, must continually be put into new contexts, reinterpreted from different points of view, and confronted with experience and different interpretations and new revelations. It should be apparent that the scholarly approach is integral to constructive theology. Understanding the range of views and interpretations of others is vital to those who take this approach. However, they go further than scholars because they are committed to creating a new understanding. They realize, however, that a new understanding is not a final understanding. In this, they are perhaps more like artists than traditional theologians, treating the same themes in different ways rather than trying to write the definitive work on Mormon doctrine. Because theology and philosophy share, to a certain extent, the same subject matter, The relationship between theology and philosophy is complex. Both disciplines are concerned with the nature of truth, reality, meaning, and ethics. Philosophers, of course, do not have to discuss God, while theologians must. As I have said, for Mormon theologians, revelation must be fundamental, but philosophers choose their own fundamentals. Theology can learn much from philosophy, how to reason, the limitations of reason, what questions to ask, and others, but it must be aware of the danger of becoming philosophy if it fails to maintain revelation as fundamental. Another danger I see for theology resulting from the similar subject matter of theology and philosophy is that people will come to feel that theology demands philosophical methods or that a philosophical approach to theology is somehow better than other approaches. But theology can be greatly enriched by other disciplines as well, by philosophy, literature, anthropology, psychology, linguistics, physics, and even, or probably especially, daily life and disciplehood itself. Indeed, without drawing from some other area of learning or life, theology has nothing to say, no medium of interpretation. What I'm saying here is that every Mormon should be a constructive theologian. I could argue that each of us must construct his own theology as we try to understand our scriptures and religious concepts and to make sense of our individual and communal experience from a religious perspective and as we seek righteousness. However, most Mormons do not consciously accept the approach to theology that I've outlined here. For the Orthodox thinkers, this constructive theology is unacceptable for at least two reasons. First, its conception of truth as relative is threatening and upsetting and simply wrong to those who believe in absolute truth. Second, it undermines their concept of authority. They believe in a body of doctrine revealed to the prophets which all church members should believe in and not question. In the paper I presented at last year's symposium, I attempted to show that orthodoxy is inherently divisive and oppressive and in opposition to revelation. Constructive theology considers revelation to be fundamental, but rather than equating revelation with authority, as orthodox theology does, it emphasizes its experiential nature and its availability to everyone. Joseph Smith said, "No man can receive the Holy Ghost without receiving revelations, and the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy." Orthodox thinkers assume that all members should believe the same, while constructive believers... Okay, I won't go through the rest of this. I'll give you the conclusion. Briefly, scholarly and philosophical thinkers may object to my view because they find that the demand for revelation is going against their demand for an objective point of view. And I just say a couple of things. I don't think that when we demand that, or we have this belief that revelation should be important to each person as he thinks through his theology, it doesn't mean that he can use this in a way that coerces others. The idea is that everyone is entitled to revelation in constructing his theology, and that we share these beliefs with each other as a gift, not as a way of compelling belief.
Well, I missed your conclusion because of the helicopter.
Rambo is flying by.
Did they work?
Well, they're only recording it. It's for recording.
Oh. Where's the other one?
So the people can hear the helicopter on
Let me do it for you.
Okay.
You're all set then.
My name is Mark Gustafson. I have a prepared speech today, and I'll try and keep it as short as possible. If I could ask you maybe to pick up the pages as I throw them at you. Mormonism has always been, as both critics and apologists delight in pointing out, a religion possessing some thoroughly remarkable theological and social beliefs. The Mormon tradition celebrates this fact by defining itself as a restoration of ancient codes of conduct and systems of belief, distinct in principal part from other Western Christian traditions. That declaration was not just a heuristic device to define the outlines of a newly emergent faith. Key theological elements of the historic Mormon tradition, to be briefly defined in a moment, have been traditionally cited as evidence for the actual and revealed status of the Mormon religion. Those essential Mormon beliefs can be briefly outlined as these. 1, the metaphysical autonomy of individual human beings. 2, the supremacy of law. 3, the rejection of ex nihilo creation. 4, the corporeality of the gods, both male and female. 5, the possibility of eternal moral progression for individual human beings. And finally, the rejection of the notion of a disabling original sin. Unhappily, and this is where I shall sure to be in trouble with you, Paul, under the relentless and displacing influence of the larger Western Christian culture and Mormonism's shameless pandering after the fleshpots of public acceptability. Key elements of traditional Mormon belief have been under assault from a vocal and well-spoken group. Those voices which have been and are found in pulpit and pew, and not surprisingly, at least historically from BYU, have been busily about the effort of dismantling distinctive elements of traditional Mormon belief in favor of an incoherent bag of mythopoetic claims. First, may I examine those six areas. Historic Mormonism preached that the individual soul is uncreated and co-eternal with God. That idea carries with it a wealth of derivative assumptions about the human character. At a minimum, it endorses political, democratic political systems matched by constitutions which recognize and protect inherent rights. Additionally, the notion of an uncreated eternal soul also insulates the individual conscience from paternalistic religious organizations which, in their push to perfect the individual, attempt to accomplish that goal regardless of the specific wishes of human beings regarding their consent. Critically, this central Mormon idea required God to persuade humanity, to invite individual human beings to join in the God's great purposes for the salvation of the human race. No commands or irresistible injunctions could be heard among the saints. Only by gentle persuasion, we were at least once taught, can anything of enduring value be achieved. Furthermore, the notion of an uncreated and autonomous self emboldens each individual to view their life as a series of possibilities for genuine, individual, and autonomous achievement without the displacing effect of irresistible grace which traditional Mormonism implicitly denied. On the other hand, efforts to make the human personality and existence dependent upon the decisions of God and attempts to enhance God's authority and power always come at the expense of individual human autonomy. Elements of Mormon neo-orthodoxy spend a great deal of time and effort focusing on the majesty of God while hobbling humanity with notions of inherent sin and corruption, just the thing Joseph Smith sought to reverse in the King Follett sermon. It is hard to imagine how notions of personal worth and moral power can prosper in such a poisoned field. Second, the idea that both God and humanity are subject to a set of uncreated and supreme natural laws is parasitic upon the notion that all souls, whether presently mortal or one day divine, share metaphysical necessity and eternal worth. Critically, the idea of the supremacy of law provides a mechanism to restrain discretion and the use of rules for purely individual agendas. In both mortality and in the heavens, the rule of universal law preserves civility in the face of tyranny and controls evil with the threat of consequence and justice. There is no divine command theory of ethics or law in historic Mormon theology. Claims are not morally good for the reason that God says so, but because any claim is defensible precisely because that is the way things are, which fact God recognizes and passes along for our enlightenment. The importance of this idea is plain. If, for instance, things were of a certain sort because God said they were that way, then the universal temptation would be to change the rules of the game to suit transient conditions and individual interests. I'm editing here as I go along. However, to the extent that the presumption of God's omniscience and omnipotence are believed and promoted, as they are within most strains of Mormon neo-orthodoxy, they again come at the expense of the historic Mormon idea of the supremacy of law. If law is supreme, for instance, there are some things that God just can't do, namely to rearrange the structure of nature, among others. On the other hand, if God's absolute power and authority is the focus of theological interest, then the divine command theory of ethics suddenly finds a fresh field in which to throw up its thorns. Historic Mormonism most clearly breaks with tradition, with classical Christian theism, when it expressly denies that God brought the world into existence through an act of ex nihilo creation. The critical importance of this idea can scarcely be overestimated. The affirmation that the world was organized rather than created defines the gods by their purposes, not by their unbridled power. According to the classical Christian creeds, the creative act, which extends not only to matter but to the individual soul, which also sprang, in their view, into existence from nothingness, was of such a character and sort that the world could be characterized as a creature of God. In fact, so profound was that creative act that traditional Christian theism was thought by some to require God's continuing creative act to sustain reality, or else everything would slip back into nothingness. Historic Mormonism's rejection of ex nihilo creation also dovetails nicely with the traditional Mormon embrace of the idea of an uncreated and universally applicable law. If matter must be organized and cannot be created from nothingness, then it must be arranged according to some overweening principles that necessarily guide that effort. Joseph Smith sensed the critical importance of this idea when he observed that it was his purpose to collapse the metaphysical distance between deity and mortals for the purpose of sanctifying and empowering well-intentioned human beings. But once again, to the extent the Mormon neo-orthodoxy emphasizes God's authority, knowledge, and raw power, then Mormons start to use words like omniscience and omnipotence in something like the ways that would please St. Thomas Aquinas. It is important to be clear here. To the extent that Mormon neo-orthodoxy focuses on God's power, then the distinctive and historic Mormon finitism and all that is entailed by it has been compromised. The anthropomorphism of traditional Mormon deities continues to inspire ridicule among critics of the Church. Traditionally, the body parts and passions of deity were meant to be understood in precisely the same ways that mortals understand those phrases, except that, of course, Mormons assumed that God conquered selfishness and had become morally purified. Mormonism has fairly thundered on this point. Human beings are in the exact likeness of God, male and female, a thought which has been echoed in recent moves to develop the notion of a literal mother in heaven. In fact, it is exactly the literal motherness and femaleness of the female deity that has correctly emboldened those among us who have sought to understand and love and appreciate the equivalently powerful but little known celestialized God the Mother, who stands in equal status with God the Father. In that regard, I can find no logically or morally sufficient reason why the Mormon priesthood has been denied to qualified women, which opinion I've held for over a decade. In fact, it is my view that traditional Mormon metaphysics can be marshaled into a logical argument to support the expansion of the priesthood to women, a notion sure to puzzle advocates for Mormon neo-orthodoxy who seem to be satisfied that only their tortured reading of Mormon theology could be cited as support for extending the priesthood to morally qualified women. I am editing here as we go along. If the literal anthropomorphism of the Mormon gods is seen as inconsistent with classical Christian theism, imagine what the effect of the notion of eternal progression of the individual soul has had. Deriving its basis from the metaphysical and moral autonomy of the human soul, this traditional Mormon idea held, until just after the Second World War, that there was literally no end to the achievements that could be realized during mortality and after death by a sufficiently motivated human soul. So profound was that ability that key Mormon spokespersons even declared that certain individuals could jump kingdoms, with some of them achieving some species of godhood. As you might expect, radical Mormon anthropomorphism has met its fair share of critics, too many of which are merely polemical. Taking some cues from the Neoplatonic and later Christian suspicion of the world and the material composing it, which had a nasty habit of decaying and becoming corrupt, traditional Christianity has opted in favor of God's absolute power and authority. Such limited power was considered to be logically incompatible with a corporeal reality which implied corruption and change. Of course, creedal Christianity was merely engaging in a sophisticated tautology. If you define God in the way that Augustine or St. Thomas did, it is no surprise that the restrictions of matter would be inconsistent with the nature and power of such a deity. And not unexpectedly, Mormon neo-orthodoxy has also weighed in on this point. The idea of an inherently corrupted soul matched with the notion of irresistible grace is inconsistent with the idea of eternal progression. I'm going to edit quickly to my conclusion.
Wait for the helicopter. Gotta be fair.
In my judgment, the effort of Mormon neo-orthodoxy to redefine Mormon belief has been sponsored by a clear desire to reconcile the Mormon faith to the creeds of traditional Christianity. More charitably, Mormon neo-orthodoxy has also sought to make some sense of the horror of this century, though that belief of theirs has only made matters worse. Though the neo-orthodox effort will be ultimately unsuccessful because creedal Christianity at its theological core is inconsistent with historic Mormon belief, their labors continue unabated. However, though the public and private debates between spokespersons of traditional and neo-orthodox Mormonism are often strident, it is essential to recall that it is a struggle between principles, not personalities. However vigorous the debate, uncharitable personal attacks in whatever form must never characterize this exchange of ideas. Nevertheless, in our desire to be pleasant, even as the philosophical battle rages, it is important not to discount the seriousness of the intellectual exchange that is currently going on. In every important way, a very real struggle is occurring for the mind and soul of Mormon belief. That sounds like an outrageous characterization, only to the extent that the significance and content of that struggle is unrecognized or misunderstood. For any culture to maintain its identity, to resist the ubiquity of ecumenism, it has an interest in fostering those distinctive elements which define the outlines of its beliefs by fashioning an intellectual structure to defend and make sense of those creedal statements. As cultures age, the forces of history tend to hammer flat the peaks of distinguishing belief. In that process, even the most initially radical and contending systems of belief end up being nearly indistinguishable from one another. However apocalyptic in character my analysis has been, Mormonism must successfully resist the debilitating efforts of its emergent neo-orthodoxy if it is to survive as a viable and distinctive culture. Thank you.
How do we hook this up? Thanks. Hook me up.
He may have.
Beam me up.
And put this one on my lapel.
Right.
Looks like it's got
this lapel is easier.
You prefer this one?
Well, just whatever.
This one is so that
okay, great. My call. What luck! Okay. My comments are highly personal, speculative, and informal, which is precisely the situation in which I find Mormon feminist theology. What is feminist theology? I define feminism as the condition or philosophy of being female. Therefore, I use the term theology, which is thea, goddess, and logi, study of. Feminist theology can be an examination of or relationship to the divine female. Or it can be theology that is done by females. Why do feminist theology? Referring to Christ as an illegitimate child, Jung noted that when the personal father is missing, and more particularly when he is completely unknown, there is no layer of personal experience to mediate between the ego and the archetypal father. A kind of hole is left in the psyche. Such a condition is a danger. It threatens inundation of the ego to the dynamic forces of the unconscious, causing disorientation and loss of relation to external reality. If you substitute the word mother for father in this text, you have a description of the spiritual and theological state of Mormon women. He also reveals a kind of object relations theory. Notions of the divine guide our mystical inner lives. Lack of a female god leaves women psychologically crippled. I believe that women must have a direct connect female and must be able to commune in some way with it in order to act with conviction, authority, validity, and purpose. The divine female is basic and inherent in Mormon theology, yet remains undeveloped and undefined, lacking doctrine, revelation, and ritual. Mormon theology stipulates an anthropomorphic female god of equal power and glory to the Father, yet she remains officially unknown and unwritten. Therefore, she must be composed unofficially. In a paper for the Mormon Women's Forum, I compared the faceless, nameless mother in Mormon theology to a Medusa, who cannot be looked upon for fear that she or we may not survive this encounter. Some more reasons why do feminist theology? Because historically it hasn't been done. Feminist theory in Mormonism has generally been limited to cultural and liberal feminism, and official Mormon feminist theology consists of one phrase in a song. Why? Why do feminist theology? Because the Mother Mary, consort God, and son Jesus Christ are one more version of a repeated myth of the goddess who takes a consort, bears a son, and is then supplanted by him. Why do feminist theology? Because we make ourselves in the image of God. And as Joseph Smith powerfully illustrated, one good mythmaker can have a far greater impact on our lives and our children's lives for generations than a school of industrious social scientists. Thanks. Why do feminist theology? Because it is problematic and unlikely that official theology and revelation concerning the Mormon goddess will occur in Mormonism, since no women are formally authorized to create policy or doctrine for the church. Therefore, we are left to speculative theology. Why do feminist theology? Because those who dictate the divine are unable to fully embrace it, and those who embrace it cannot dictate it. Therefore, in patriarchal Christian religions such as Mormonism, men articulate an unapproachable divine, and women approach an unspeakable divine, which leaves both of us spiritually crippled. Why do feminist theology? Because men generally do not assert the female. They assert the male, and women must assert the female if balance is desirable or is ever to be achieved. Third, in my view, after giving you all the reasons why to do feminist theology, I personally believe we should not be asking why do feminist theology, but I think what we should be asking is why hasn't feminist theology been done all along, and why have women worshipped the male? Historically, I see Mormon feminist theology as having its genesis with Lucy Mack Smith, in a kind of version of the goddess consort son scenario with Joseph Smith and Joseph Jr. Lucy had visionary expectations and drive for the restoration, but fed her spiritual insight into her son to make of him the vessel. Thus, through female self-subordination, male vision supplanted the female at the genesis of Mormonism. Joseph Smith and Eliza R. Snow briefly asserted and articulated the divine female in Mormonism. Zebedee Coltrane was reported to have had a vision of the Mother in Heaven. Erastus Snow described a male-female god. Emmeline Wells asserted advancement of women. But that about sums up the extent of 19th century Mormon theology. In the 20th century, we have the full spectrum of feminism and Mormonism. Still, Mormon theology is a step rarely taken. The existence of the female version of God was asserted by Rudger Clausen, Bruce R. McConkie, Hugh B. Brown, Joseph Fielding Smith, James E. Talmadge, B.H. Roberts, John A. Widsow, Melvin J. Ballard, Spencer Kimball, and Neil Maxwell, among others, according to Linda Wilcox's historical survey. Linda traced the evolution of the doctrine of the Mother in Heaven. Margaret Toscano has decried the missing female in Mormon theology, and Linda Newell has strenuously urged female connection to the divine. I have seen these three women like voices crying in the wilderness for an emerging theology. Other women citing female relationship to authority of the divine are people like Meg Wheatley, Melody Mensch Charles, Carol Cornwall Madsen, Greta Peterson, Jolene Rockwood, Sonia Farnsworth, Todd Compton, Ian Barber, Mike Quinn, Ed Firmage, Doris Elliott, Marion Yates Merrill, and the list goes on. I don't have time to read them all. Still, to review the history of women as God or not in Mormonism serves its own purpose, to see what has happened elsewhere, other than here and now. To work at the concept of woman as God or priestess is an attitude or existence, as attitude or existence is theology. Recently, there's been an explosion of goddess awareness among Mormon women. With women like Carolyn Pearson, I left out Janice Allred earlier. Janice Allred, Paul Toscano, the women of the Mormon Women's Forum, who I want to name, Karen Case, Kelly Frame, Martha Pierce, Julie Nichols, Bettina Lindsay, Lynn Whitesides, Rebecca England, Sydney Jones, Yvonne Wright, Andrea Emmett, Ellen Toscano, Marty Esplin, myself, and others, many others, have urged the development and worship of the Mormon female deity. Many women poets have also expressed her. I think it's important for you to hear these names and know that we've come together at this point in Mormon history to give birth to a female deity in Mormonism. All these women and some men are united in non-hierarchical, group, consensual, speculative, and as Janice called it, constructive theology. And I really like Janice's term. I don't see this as very different from the kinds of arguments and discussions that Pratt and Clayton and others had in informal settings in the early days of the church on trips back and forth across the plains when they were devising theology in the 19th century. Personal conviction, experience, intuition, visualization of the divine female are contributing to a body of knowledge concerning her. I've seen a couple of different approaches in this. The first I've seen is a kind of affirmative action theology where all that has been given to the male will be extended to the female, goddesshood, priestesshood, authority, and a kind of materialist Newtonian expression of the goddess. A second approach is an intuitive, essentialist, separatist rejection of male models and systems for a female-generated, distinct female way of doing things, or female epistemology, if you will. The church, it seems, has tended to favor the affirmative action approach over the intuitive approach. A third approach that has postmodernist parallels does not try to describe and thus confine God, which would prevent us from truly knowing him or her or it. The question is not what is God or where is the Great Mother, but what is femaleness? What is maleness? Where is it? Is it reified? Are there archetypes? Is there a divine? Is it within? Is it embraceable? These kind of arguments embrace essentialist versus constructionist views on what is male and female. Another approach to the female is a view of Christ as an androgynous being that inscribes the female. Though I personally am very compelled by notions of an androgynous being or even a genandromorphic being, divine, I see Jesus Christ as clearly male. And I think that these kind of inscriptions of the female make of Christ the bleeding man, a menstruating male. Attributing female or divine female characteristics to Christ does not include the female for me. It usurps and invalidates the female. I see Christ as being about the salvation of the male and not the salvation of the female. I do not see Christ, a man, as a symbol of female suffering. A man does not suffer in the flesh in the same way that women suffer in the flesh. And therefore, because of the difference in the body and the way that the body is experienced, I see that Christ actually has not suffered in the flesh what women experience in the flesh. If there needs to be a symbol of human suffering, especially female suffering, it might be a pregnant woman or a woman giving birth. I believe that there's a need for a Christa. A Christa is necessary, in my opinion, for female salvation. There's a clear precedent in Mormonism for a goddess, but not one for a Christa. In the above-mentioned individual, isolated, fragmented, and group efforts, Mormon women and men have tried to do female-oriented theology. In this effort, I think we are pushing and breaking through psychological boundaries. During the April 1990 General Conference, last April, a Mormon General Authority, Gordon B. Hinckley, addressed the problem of theology and became the second man in the church, in the history of the church, since Orson Pratt, to speak against worshiping God the Mother. This dictum was not given to members, but uttered behind our backs in a closed meeting for regional representatives only. Hinckley identified four cornerstones of church responsibility, the first of which is to keep the church doctrinally pure. He said, and I quote, "We need to be alert to the small beginnings of apostasy and make correction where necessary. Here and there, prayers have been offered to our Mother in Heaven, and this is beginning to spread to prayers offered in some of our meetings. However, in light of the instruction we've received from the Lord himself, I consider it inappropriate for anyone in the church to pray to our Mother in Heaven. I have looked in vain for any instance where any president of the church has offered a prayer to our Mother in Heaven. The fact that we do not pray to our Mother in Heaven no way belittles or denigrates her. None of us knows anything about her. I caution you to counsel priesthood leaders to be on the alert for the use of this expression and to make correction where necessary in a discreet and inoffensive way, but firm and without equivocation. I use this only as an example of our need to keep the doctrine pure." I want to make 3 points if I have time. Okay. Real quick, I want to say that I find it very contradictory that he says that he personally considers it inappropriate for anyone in the church to pray to our Mother in Heaven. In that way, he's validating personal revelation on a church scale, since he is not the prophet. But on the other hand, he's invalidating women having that same opportunity. Second, he says none of us knows anything about her, which is an honest confession, but not a valid reason for not pursuing knowledge about her. And third, he says, I say this just to keep the doctrine pure. Apparently, Brother Hinckley considers the Mother in Heaven doctrinally impure. Perhaps he fears the impurity of the female. This is an ancient superstition where the female is connected to uncleanness, and in that way he can find much company among medieval clerics. This is a direct assault on the divine female and the Mormon female in order to keep both suppressed, yet it was hidden so that we wouldn't know about it. Perhaps our mother is a Medusa. I'm going to wind up here. Personally, in my introduction to my anthology, Mormon Women and Authority, Reemerging Feminism, I call for female and male expression and worship of the divine female in Mormonism. We must see the divine female in ourselves as present, describe them in vision, words, text, testimonies, scriptures, hymns, poetry and prayers, paintings and depictions, holy books, rituals, and in temples. So, see notions of theology and ecclesiology as related to notions of authority, which I define as authority. I hyphenate the word to mean the act of or state of creating, the ability to create. The word author comes from the root word otor, or create. See, above all, I urge female freedom to express with full creativity and full authority the female in Mormon religious life and thought. Thanks.
There are those presently in Mormon circles who would have you leave your comfortable home of at least some recognizable doctrine to fly off to Mount Olympus to cavort with the gods of theology or of mythology so that you can better understand what you can't directly understand except for through their own writings. I believe that what's at issue here isn't so much as whether we're going to think in terms of myth or in terms of logic as whether we're going to think in terms that we have received as a tradition and that are recognizable within our revelations, because that's exactly what's at issue in the ongoing debate between Mormon neo-orthodoxy and what I would suspect are more traditional views. I'm going to tell you about my own experience and why I have the reaction that I do. As I came to the study of Mormonism, I was already too late, too old to have thought about it before I knew that I had Mormonism in my head. I suspect that many of you are like this. And by the time I was in priesthood, I already had heard the same lesson so many times over and over again that I knew I was not going to learn anything new when I went to Sunday school. But here come the Mormon Neo-Orthodox people who tell me that what I heard all the time growing up is not only inadequate, it was completely wrong. And what I'm hearing now has no relationship to what I deem to be the most vital and central elements of Mormon thought. And so, with all due respect to both Sunday school teachers and those who think they didn't do a very good job, I'm going to tell you why I think that we ought to explore traditional Mormonism more thoroughly before we run off to cavort with the deities on Mount Olympus. First of all, as I approached Mormon thought, I approached it more or less from a very traditional point of view. I suspect that all of you come out of that point of view because you can't criticize something until you know what it is. But I was quite sure I didn't have a very good grasp of it because, after all, my Sunday school teachers didn't do a very good job. The reality is that as I looked more and more into Mormon thought, I realized that it was a very radical break with an existing tradition, and that what it represented was, in fact, a new way of dissolving old problems. I say dissolving because Mormonism refuses to acknowledge the very problems that plague traditional theology. Let me give you some idea what I'm talking about here. I think that we can very faithfully claim that Mormonism has at least some very distinctive views with relation to what we think the cosmos is, what we think God is, and what we think our relation is to the two. With respect to the cosmos, we approach an understanding of who and what God's relationship is to the cosmos very, very differently. You heard Peter Appleby tell you this morning that there's a great metaphysical dichotomy built in to conventional Christian theology. I call it conventional rather than orthodox, because orthodox is a judgment that is correct, whereas conventional is a judgment merely that that's the way it's been for a while. And in fact, that is merely the way it's been for a while, but that's not the way it started out. Yeah, I believe it started out more or less in a very broad tradition that could accept a very broad range of views that was very pre-critical, not philosophical in any way. But the very first question that the Christians began to ask themselves was, well, what do I mean when I say God? And what is a father? And what do I mean when I say a Messiah or a Christ? And how does that fit into the view that there's evil in the world, or those kinds of questions? They're very natural questions. They may be third grade questions, but they're third grade because everybody asked those kinds of questions. And as they pursued those kind of questions, they more or less drafted their theology into what was an existing worldview, a Neoplatonic worldview, wherein God basically didn't change at all. He was outside of everything. And the major fear that they had is that God might be kind of like an unfaithful wife. After all, how can you trust a God who might not be there tomorrow, or who in some way might change? Even worse, if God is already the best that he can be, how could you hope that he could possibly be any better? And you would certainly hope that he not be any worse. So what you want is a God who can't change. Moreover, you want a God who can't be like us. You see, if you've ever noticed a dead body, they start decomposing right away. And nobody wants a God who's falling apart from the inside out. So they developed a very faithful, I think, to their fears type of theology. It was a theology which made sense of Neoplatonic thought. Then came along Joseph Smith, who didn't know anything about Neoplatonism or anything about theology, and all he really knew was that he didn't have any Sunday school teachers to teach him anything, and he wanted to know. What he developed refused to enter into the problems developed by this system of thought, simply because he didn't have those problems. The problem of a God over against a world who had no reason whatsoever to create, but when he created it, put himself... and us, I believe, at great risk through the evils that would occur in the world, I think is a gigantic gain in theology. When Joseph Smith made God a part of this reality in which we have to do, a God who not only changes, but changes in the most amazing ways conceivable. And I believe at the very base of what Joseph Smith was doing, refusing to enter into the discussion, was simply looking at Jesus of Nazareth and saying, how can it be that this very person here in front of me is God? If, after all, what I mean by God is what's up there and outside of the world, if you're telling me that the man sitting in front of me is God, the proper response is to go call the men with their white coats to come take this guy away. The proper response isn't to kneel down. But what Joseph Smith did was to understand that this truly was a true revelation of God, that the man that was walking around Nazareth somehow truly revealed what was to be understood by God. God was among us once again. There was no notion in Jesus' thought whatsoever of an intrinsically evil human being. He never addressed the issue, so I conclude it just wasn't very interesting to him. However, now we have a Mormon neo-orthodoxy that arises, which tells us that the way Mormonism has approached reality is all wrong. Instead of thinking of God as being among beings, a part of our universe who changes along with us and is very interested in the outcome of what happens here, we have a being who, in whose mind, I suppose, we were some kind of potential. I don't know what a potential is, but I think it has less status even than a thought in God's mind, not even yet a twinkle in his eye. And as things developed, things only got worse, because for some reason God undertook to make it so that persons would enter into a world where they had some kind of depravity. You see, he knew all about it, set it up so that it would happen, knew it was going to happen beforehand, and he set it up such that we would come with this terrible inability to recognize even right and wrong. You see, we're so blind because of both our cultural ignorances and others that we can't quite get out of it. And the only way out of it is magic. They call it grace, but whether you call it grace or magic, it amounts to the very same thing. You haven't done anything about it, and suddenly you're saved. I don't think that it has anything to do with the traditional Mormonism that I've learned about. Now, in some ways, I've caricatured the positions that I'm referring to because I don't have time to carefully elucidate them. But I believe that I could back up the kinds of caricatures that I've rendered. They'll deny that I've accurately discussed them, but I believe that the actual implications of their views reduce to these types of positions. Feminist theology, some very valuable types of feminist theology, insensitive types of feminist theology. But the type of feminist theology that I've heard elucidated is not any of those things. Instead, I believe it is a reinstantiation of the old sexism which gave rise to the problem in the first place. You see, if the problem is that our Father in heaven can't understand us in any way, even though he's omniscient, one would have to understand what that means. If he can't understand women because they're so disparate and different from men, then truly we do need a Mother God if we're going to have any God whatsoever. But I think that that's simply a misunderstanding of what God is. Moreover, to assert that you can't understand simply because of your sex seems to me to be the worst form of sexism. The kind of sexism that isn't argued, it merely assumes that you're going to agree with it. Second, to assert that a male God is somehow inadequate because he can't save females seems to me to be based upon faulty understanding of what is entailed. If what is asserted is that God can't save women because he can't understand them, that seems to me to assume that men and women are so vastly different that men don't understand women. I suggest the corollary is that women don't understand men. But if women don't understand men, how can the feminist theologians understand God the Father enough to know he doesn't understand? I don't understand it. Further, it seems to me that feminism in our century is based upon a correct recognition of equality of sexes and not the disparateness of sexes, upon the fact that we share common humanity, or common humanity, if you wish, I don't know. But it seems to me that there can be a very sensitive type of feminine theology within Mormonism without going to any of the extremes of asserting that men can't talk about it. Worse yet, it seems to me that our current feminist movement, one that's very valuable, is based upon the recognition that women can do just about anything a man can do. And there's only one difference, and that's a difference I can't conceive, literally. So I think we need to base our theology upon our commonality. And I think that we need to base our theology upon our distinctiveness. Moreover, I think we need to recognize the strengths of our theology before we run off to Mount Olympus to find what the gods are doing there. Thank you.
Well, one of the problems I've had over the years in these debates is that I really don't. I think it's a lot of shadow boxing because I think Margaret and I and Janice and some other people who have written on this subject have been classified as neo-orthodox when we're not neo-orthodox. This neo-orthodoxy movement, which was in Protestantism,
I just don't believe in the things that Mark says or even Blake says that I believe in. And I think I can speak for the others too. I mean, I believe in a progressing deity that's embodied. I don't believe in the omnis. I believe that God is powerful, maybe more powerful than all the rest of us. It says that, you know, that one intelligence, if there's two of them, there's one greater than they, and I am greater than they all. So I believe in some kind of powerful God, but I don't believe that that's infinite in some philosophical sense. I don't believe in going to Mount Olympus. I mean, I think it's interesting to go into other mythologies and explore there what I think God has put there to see if that can help illuminate my own tradition and my own understandings, but that doesn't mean I'm going to worship Zeus or believe somehow that we're going to be saved by believing in fertility cults and things like that. Although maybe fertility cults are kind of interesting. I don't believe in neo-orthodoxy. I don't even believe in orthodoxy, as I said before. I don't believe in a right way of thinking about religion. I believe that theology is essentially, for me, it's not systematic theology, but it's an ongoing discussion among people who care about the subject of God and his dealings with people and the texts that have arisen upon those discussions, and to try to illuminate and understand our own existential or experiential situation in the present based upon what has happened traditionally and what is happening to us in the present, in our psychologies, in our dreams, in our actions, in our church institution, in our power structures, in our homes, that kind of thing. Now, I don't know why. I think one of the reasons why I don't like another reason I don't like the word neo-orthodoxy is because it's kind of naming the animal so you can issue hunting licenses for it. I just don't like that idea. I mean, and then traditional sounds so kind of, this is what we've always done, but neo-orthodoxy is something new and strange and alien. Well, you know, the belief that man is an eternal being, I believe in that. The belief that he was always autonomous is not something that you can derive directly from the King Follett discourse. It's confusing. So it gives rise to an argument about that question. I don't know if autonomy was meant. I mean, a fetus is kind of autonomous, kind of not. I think that we were kind of like that. It's got rights, it's got an independent existence, but seems to be part of the mother, is it, isn't it? It gives rise to the problem with the abortion question and the pro-choice, pro-life question. It's hard to come to one side or the other on it. And I don't know what the answer is. When it comes to the depravity question, I've used that term. I don't mean that people are really depraved. I guess I was wrong maybe to use that. I guess what I mean to say is that I don't believe that people are mature or fully ripe like God is, that God is far more experienced and powerful than we are, and therefore we need his help for salvation, and that without his help, salvation has got to be possible for us, simply because I don't know anybody that can resurrect himself or herself. And I don't know anybody that can forgive themselves so adequately. Some people have done things that self-forgiveness is what's necessary. But in the grand cosmic scheme of things, I think we do need forgiveness. And we do need someone to help us spiritually. To help, we are. I think our plight is that we're trapped in mortality in a world that's separated from God, and we need help to get back through the veil and get back there. And I think that's the grace of God. That help, whatever, however you define it, is God's grace, and I think that operates in us. I think Blake believes in grace. I think believe in it a little differently, but there's a lot of commonality in our points of view. And I object strenuously to the attempt, either of Blake or Mark or others, to see us as somehow alien to the Mormon tradition. The very fact that we believe in continuing revelation, that we accept the restoration movement, and I prefer to call it restorational Mormonism as opposed to neo-orthodox, because I believe we're part of a restoration movement. And we believe that the gospel has been restored, but also many things have been restored. Some from Mount Olympus, some from Egypt, as we all know, some from the Masons, some from witchcraft. All of this has been brought into Mormonism, little pieces and bits of this and that, that you can trace to this and that. I don't object to that. And also, I don't think that it has been strongly enough noted that there's a downside to the belief that human beings are all sufficient and capable of their own salvation. I mean, it makes people heady and arrogant. And systems of law have been built upon that arrogance, such as Stalinism and Nazism, where people believed that they were the super race, the pure, the ones who were destined to bring about the mighty and strong. They're always a terrible group of people, these people. And I guess one of the reasons why I like to think of God as more powerful and someone upon whom we need to rely is because I am as... they're more worried about the fact that that undercuts human beings. Well, if you take it too far, it does. But if you take the idea of human autonomy too far, human self-perfectibility too far, then you have a bunch of Nazis marching around with arms akimbo and lockstep synchronization, making us all march through the veil at the same time and in the same way. I mean, I am as worried about that reality as the other. And so my feeling is to try to achieve a balance. Now, Margaret and I have written a book, and Blake is referring obliquely to it, and he doesn't like parts of it, and I don't blame him, and that's perfectly fine. But the very fact that we are trying to participate in an ongoing dialogue, I don't like the characterization of neo-orthodoxy as something alien. I agree with James Faulkner. I read his paper. I didn't get a chance to go to that session because I was doing another one. He talks about theology that's got to be, what did you call it, erotic reading. I love that. Erotic means it leads to pregnancy and you're stuck with this thing that it's not part of you, but it is part of you and it's going to come out and become its own person and it's going to change the world, say, change your life. That's how theology is. It's always pregnant with something that's going to come out of it, that's going to challenge what you've always believed. And we may have to revisit our theories of grace. And we may have to live for a long time without philosophical neatness in our theology before we can arrive at something that works for us. I remember, it's like a cafeteria. You go into a cafeteria and you pick the things you like and you come out and say, what a great Italian restaurant. Because you just picked all the Italian food. But if you picked all the Chinese food, it would have been a great Chinese restaurant. If you picked all the great American food, it would have been an American restaurant. You can't classify it that way. You pick and choose the things that you want out of our experience. That's important. But there's no reason to go back and label that restaurant a Chinese or an American. It is what it is. A cafeteria has a lot in it. And I'm glad to be able to choose, and I'll go back and maybe my taste will change and I'll see it differently. This argument about neo-orthodox reminds me, and I'll say this in closing, about a panel of Peanuts cartoons that I saw years ago. And it was Charlie Brown is walking along with Lucy Van Pelt. And they're walking along, and she looks down and she says, "Oh, look at the queen ant. It's so large, so much bigger than the other ants. And look at how all the other ants are ministering to her and waiting upon her." And Charlie Brown looks down and he says, that's not a queen ant, it's a jelly bean. And Lucy looks up and she says, "Gee, I wonder how a jelly bean got to be queen." It seems like no matter how much I repeat the point that we are not neo-orthodox, it is not a queen ant, it is a jelly bean, we are not, we fit into the jelly bean context of Mormonism, we are just a jelly bean like you. Gee, I wonder how a jelly bean got to be a queen ant, you know? You just can't get out of this. So I would like to have everybody drop neo-orthodoxy, call it constructional Mormonism, as Jana suggested, or restorational Mormonism, as Daniel may have suggested. The other is maybe progressive or traditional, I don't care. These have to be somewhat content empty. Because if you take the word neo-orthodoxy, you take all of the baggage that that has from Protestantism and Catholicism. And believe me, it doesn't carry it, at least with the group of writers that I know. It may be true for an older group, I'm not sure. Kendall White wrote an interesting book that started this debate. He's probably here somewhere. I saw him here at the opening session. And it was a good book, but he was wrong about the label. And I hope that maybe this clarifies a little bit more about the debate.
Are they going to want us out of here now, so we should not take questions?
We're the ones that are eating.
We can take a few questions. Okay, we're going to take just... I'll be arbitrary. We're going to take three questions. And I see one hand, two hand. Do I have a third hand? And I have a third hand. We will have a lot longer time. Before I take questions, let me make one announcement. Because some of you are, I see, starting to leave. This is very important for all of you. Because we're not going to get enough time for a lot of discussion now. The third session of this series on Mormon theology is going to be held in the Grand Ballroom 2. Enter at the east end, which I believe is over at this end. They've moved it to an adequate space, so you don't get to answer your get your questions out now. Do it then. Gene.
There is a group of theologians in the church, and I think they may be having more impact on the minds of developing Latter-day Saints than any of us here, for whom the label Neo-Orthodox fits. They don't believe in the Omnis. They are moving us back towards Orthodox Christianity, and they are not here. They are from BYU. They are not here for some interesting reasons that are more divisive than any of the divisions here. At least we're talking to each other. I guess I'd like to ask the question for all of us to think about, how can we get them here? Because I think that's the tragedy of Mormonism right now.
Yeah. I think there's a widespread agreement that that is true, and there is a group who, for whom that appellation is much more accurate. And my own impression, Gene, Paul, others, is that they are the true heirs of that older tradition that Kendall White talks about. They're closer to that than...
I'm just talking about the group that's been involved
that,
in
the one that Kendall White names as bad guys number one right now.
My question's for Janice. Constructive theology and speculative theology, are they close, synonymous, or on dual paths side by side? How would you epitomize those?
I think there would maybe be two differences. Speculative theology, as is seen by Orthodox thinkers, refers to questions that are not fundamental. And I think constructive theology would look at fundamental questions in what Orthodox thinkers would call a speculative way. In other words, they would want to say, let's rethink these questions. Maybe we misinterpreted something. Maybe there's another way of looking at it. It's speculative theology also is different than constructive theology, because it rests on the idea that you've got to only look at what the authorities say, that you yourself would not be getting any revelation on these particular topics. So I would say those would be the two main differences.
I think construction of this would be the looking to the authority?
No. The Orthodox who talk about speculative theology would be looking to the authority, whereas the constructive theologian would say... yeah, we have to look at what they've said, but we can also look at some other things, and it's not conclusive, I think constructive theology is speculative in the sense that it doesn't say this is authoritative, this everyone has to believe this.
One more question.
Hopefully this is something that you'll deal with in the next session, because I think it's far too complicated to deal with now. But it seems to me it's the atonement that where the real debate revolves around what do we do with the atonement. And I tend to be in the finitist camp. I mean, would you agree with that? I mean, what do we do with Christ when we have this finitist position? I know that Blake has written a lot on that. And it's probably impossible to deal with that question now, but it seems to me that's the issue around which most of the debate revolves. Right. True?
I don't think it's
question.
I think Laurie's question was whether or not the divergence of opinion between what we have characterized correctly, Paul, as the Neo-Orthodox and the traditional Mormons turns on the matter of the atonement and what we do with Christ's sacrifice in the context of human experience. I think that's certainly a key part of it, Laurie, but I don't think it's all of it. There are other issues every bit as essential, matters of theodicy, derivative questions of human autonomy and things like that, which are, in the largest sense, part and parcel of it, but I don't think we can focus all the question in on the matter of atonement.
Well, will you be dealing with that later?
I'd like to leave both the audience and the panel with one question that maybe we can reflect upon this afternoon. There's a long tradition in the history of Christian thought that the necessary foundation for doing constructive or systematic theology of whatever conclusions you reached, that the necessary groundwork was philosophy. That's in Augustine, that's in St. Thomas Aquinas, it's in 20th century. People like Paul Tillich were first-rate philosophic minds, John Macquarie, Richard Swinburne, and others. Macquarie, the premier, I see Jim back here, I saw him, premier translator of Heidegger. You know, there's a long tradition that whatever conclusions you come to, you need to master the massive philosophic tradition of the West in order to properly articulate and understand Scripture. And yet on our panel, I see three lawyers and two people coming from other sorts of directions. And I'm just wondering whether or not we think that is a useful thing to do.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Three people.